Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with our discussion of the fact that, yes, the aliens are still not among us. As we saw in the first half hour, there is a very real possibility that people could be misled by the power of the media into believing just about anything. Indeed, the more one studies political affairs, the more the role of the media as a controller of public opinion looms large and altogether significant. Among the things I want to refer listeners to is a pair of interviews with Christopher Simpson, the brilliant author of, among other titles, The Science of Coercion, put out in hardcover and softcover by the Oxford University Press and copyright 1994. That book is subtitled Psychological Warfare and Communications Research, 1945 to 1960. And it has a lot to say about the power of communications research and the extent to which the powers that be have studied how to manipulate the public consciousness. In dealing with the perpetration of the E.T. myth, I think it's very important to understand not only that the E.T. concept is a myth, but that it could be used as a cover for a lot of different things. Indeed, I wonder to what extent the whole alien abduction okey-doke is in fact a cover for a very real program of experimentation on American citizens, perhaps genetic engineering, perhaps mind-controlled experimentation, perhaps a number of different things, only using the E.T. okey-doke as a cover. That's a possibility that I think needs to be very seriously considered. One of the best books about the E.T. myth, and in fact a book that goes a long way towards demonstrating that the myth of E.T.s has been deliberately perpetrated by elements of our own national security establishment, probably in conjunction with other countries' national security establishments, that book is a book called Revelations, subtitled Alien Contact and Human Deception. This book has been the basis of a couple of half-hour segments available from Spitfire. I alluded to that earlier. Those segments were done in the early summer of 1997. This particular book, again, Revelations, subtitled Alien Contact and Human Deception, has been published in softcover by... The book was published in softcover by Ballantine Books, copyright 1991. The ISBN number is 0-345-37566-1. And in a section of Revelations, Dr. Vallee has a... fairly witty and I think insightful analysis of some of the ETs are among us and are doing all sorts of nasty things nonsense. And I think one of the things that has to be seriously considered is the possibility that some of these things are actually going on, but that they're being done by humans here on Earth and not by aliens or ETs. In a section that Dr. Vallee, a section of the book Revelations, Alien Contact and Human Deception, that Vallee terms the horrible truth with deliberate irony, we read, speaking of Area 51, and among the many obvious problems would be how they dispose of their waste material, I never did find out who took care of the trash for our alien guests. But the stories about the Greys and Area 51 kept intensifying, drawing more and more rational people into a net of mystery, half-documented revelations, and hushed-up suggestions that became increasingly ominous. On December 29, 1987, John Lear issued a statement that reminded the reader, quote, Germany may have recovered a flying saucer as early as 1939. General James M. Doolittle went to Sweden in 1946 to inspect a flying saucer that crashed in Spitsbergen, unquote. And he went on, The horrible truth was known by only a few persons. They were indeed ugly little creatures, shaped like praying mantises, who were more advanced than us by perhaps a billion years. Of the original group that were the first to learn the horrible truth, several committed suicide, the most prominent of which was General James V. Forrestal, who jumped to his death from a 16th-story hospital window. President Truman quickly put a lid on the secret and turned the screws so tight that the general public still thinks that flying saucers are a joke. Lear pointed out that the first communication between these aliens and our government took place on April 30, 1964, at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico, and he stated his main point. During the period of 1969 through 71, the U.S. government made a deal with these creatures called EBEs, Extraterrestrial Biological Entities, by Dr. Detlev Bronk, B-R-O-N-K, the sixth president of Johns Hopkins University. The deal, unquote, was that in exchange for technology they would provide us, we agreed to ignore the abductions that were going on and suppress information on cattle mutilations. The EBEs assured Majestic 12 that the abductions were merely the ongoing monitoring of developing civilizations. This first part of John Lear's statement was replete with contradictions, of course. If the early crashes go back to World War II, contact with the aliens could have been established long before 1964. There is no evidence in our own technology that we have had access to any dramatic inventions which a civilization, quote, a billion years ahead of us, unquote, could surely have provided to us. And the aliens would have about as much need to request Washington's permission to do anything they please as a squadron of F-16s needs clearance from the tribal chiefs of New Guinea when they fly over. Ignoring all these contradictions, John Lear echoes New York artist Bud Hopkins' belief that the purpose of the abductions is to conduct genetic engineering experiments, including, quote, impregnation of human females and early termination of pregnancies to secure the crossbred infant, unquote. By the way, as I said before, consider the possibility that some of these things might be real, but that there are no aliens involved, but rather it's human beings conducting these experiments. Valet points out the obvious contradictions in attributing these things to aliens. However, consider the possibility that this may be a cover for human activity. Continuing with Valet's analysis. Until now, I have stayed away from the discussion of such crossbreeding because this hypothesis is so scientifically ludicrous that it does not even deserve to be refuted. It reveals a dramatic lack of information about the current state of the art in genetic engineering, not to mention developments that are forecast for the next 10 years, developments that are already the subject of massive financial investments. The idea that anyone equipped with the best in molecular biology would need to perform complicated and risky maneuvers above populated areas at night to abduct ovulating American females is just about the most outlandish suggestion I have heard in some 30 years of UFO research. Why take such ridiculous risks, especially when flying around with a technology that is so unreliable that over 50 crashes are said to have occurred in the United States alone? And they are supposed to be a billion years ahead of us. The only hypothesis more ludicrous than the genetic manipulation of human females is Lear's idea that the U.S. government would give the aliens permission to mutilate our cattle. Again, quoting Lear, in order to sustain themselves, they use an enzyme or hormonal secretion obtained from the tissue they extract from humans and animals. Cows and humans are genetically similar. In the event of a national disaster, cow blood can be used by humans. That's Lear's analysis here, and Valet goes on to comment. Any civilization billions of years in advance of ours should be able to synthesize such a straightforward thing as an enzyme essential to its survival. More simply, they should be able to cure the alleged genetic disorder that has atrophied their digestive system. But even if we set aside such obvious considerations, the aliens could be provided with access to all the cattle they could ever wish to mutilate while staying on government-controlled land. And the slaughterhouses of Chicago would be delighted to make a cash deal with any organization willing to buy from them thousands of animal organs. In my opinion, there is a genuine unexplained cattle mutilation mystery, as investigative reporter Linda Howe continues to demonstrate with her field research. But the puzzling fact in that mystery is precisely that it is not a covert operation. On the contrary, the perpetrators always look for publicity, avoiding the easy prey of animals grazing in the wild, deliberately killing cows and horses owned by civilian farmers near urban areas and on small ranches, where they are certain to arouse public confusion and anger. The mutilations are calculated to create terror. Over lunch with a friend who was a leading researcher in hematology, the study of blood, I cautiously brought up Lear's claim that cow blood could be used in an emergency human transfusion. He looked at me with a quizzical smile. He did not say to my face that it was ridiculous. Instead, he put it more gently. Jacques, if that's true, then I must go back to medical school, unquote. I pressed him. What would happen if you did such a transfusion, unquote? Instant immunological shock, he answered without hesitation. The patient would die, unquote, in minutes, unquote. So much for John Lear's statements in a field where the facts were available to anyone who would take the trouble to check them. A simple phone call to the nearest blood bank would have established the truth. What does that imply for the reliability of such so-called research in more complex matters? There is a firm called BioPure that extracts hemoglobin from cow blood, but it does not propose to inject pure cattle blood into human veins. The hemoglobin would be treated and used separately as a mere supplement in human transfusions. One of the major problems in the use of such animal products has to do with the contamination of cattle by a disease called BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. Somebody should definitely tell the aliens about BSE before they catch it. By the way, that is now called mad cow disease, something that was not as well known in 91 as it is now in 99. Continuing. Furthermore, biological research on Earth is close to putting on the market various human blood substitutes. Japan, the largest importer of blood in the world, has led this research out of concern with the contamination of the blood supply with HIV virus in recent years. Two Japanese companies, Ajinomoto and Fujirebio, have created a joint venture to market a blood substitute based on human hemoglobin. Shouldn't we assume that any alien smart enough to fly over here from some faraway planet would know as much as we do in this respect? John Lear is not bothered by such considerations. He has been told that, following the abductions and mutilations, quote, the various parts of the body are taken to underground laboratories, one of which is known to be near the small New Mexico town of Dulce. That's D-U-L-C-E. I may be mispronouncing that. This jointly occupied CIA alien facility has been described as enormous, with huge tiled walls that, quote, go on forever, unquote. Witnesses have reported huge vats filled with amber liquid with parts of human bodies being stirred inside. And then, once again, Vallée goes on to comment, when John Lear came to my home one evening in 1989, he reiterated these statements forcefully. It's hard not to like John Lear and not to be impressed by him. He is a man with the credentials of a master pilot who has flown all over the world, breaking records and going in and out of little-known airstrips in hair-raising situations. One of the three times when the Golden Gate Bridge was closed to traffic, it was to allow John Lear with a disabled two-engine aircraft to fly back to San Francisco Airport in thick fog under the bridge, 10 feet over the ocean waves. He says that many of his missions to strange places the world over were flown on behalf of secret agencies of the U.S. government, notably the CIA. And I would note that because, again, as Vallée points out, the ETs are among us myth has an awful lot of its genesis, if not all of its genesis, with the elements of our own national security establishment. Continuing. John Lear may be mistaken or misinformed. I told myself as I heard, beginning again, John Lear may be mistaken or misinformed, I told myself, as I heard him speak of New Mexico bases and little gray aliens, but he is not lying and he is certainly not an armchair traveler. His exploits are real. Presumably, his contacts are real too. Have you ever seen an alien, I asked him? No, not personally. Then how do you know they're here on Earth? One of my sources works at Area 51 near Nellis Air Force Base. He's seen one. What's his name? He jumped. I can't reveal this, he said sternly. We simply call him Dennis, unquote. Lear refused to organize a meeting with Dennis, but he urged me to meet his fellow researcher, Bill Cooper, who could tell me more about the aliens. I made arrangements to have dinner with Cooper on my very next trip to Los Angeles. By the way, Bill Cooper is the author of, among other titles, Behold a Pale Horse, that I've frequently been asked about. To make a long story short, the book would have been more appropriately called Behind a Pale Horse. Continuing. The next section is called The Cooper Briefing. Bill Cooper and his girlfriend Annie met me on March 29, 1989 at 7 o'clock on the Queen Mary. Our first contact was open and frank. Bill is a big fellow with a fleshy face marked by a scar on the right side of his forehead and another scar down the length of his nose, suggesting a life of action and real danger. For dinner, we went to the Chelsea, a seafood restaurant aboard the ship. We ordered drinks, and we jumped immediately into the subject of the aliens. No tape recording was made of our conversation. Accordingly, the following is only my own recollection of what was discussed, not a word-for-word transcript. It may differ in some details from Cooper's own recollection, and if so, I apologize to him in advance. Quote, I read your recent interview in the MUFON Journal, where you say you don't believe in MJ-12, so it made me wonder why you wanted this meeting, he began. Quote, the interview was done before I met John Lear, unquote, I replied, again quoting, but I will grant you that my position hasn't changed that much. I believe there is a UFO phenomenon which is physical in the usual sense, but it can manipulate space and time in ways I certainly don't understand. By the way, I would add, I don't necessarily subscribe to that. Perhaps that's true. There certainly are circular and other unconventionally shaped flying machines that have been flying in the Earth, developed by humans for a half century or more. That's the reality that I believe in, and there's ample documentation for that. There is no documentation for the ETs going on with Valet's analysis here. They do, he stated with sanctimonious confidence, but go on. Valet goes on to comment, quote, I further believe, as you do, that the U.S. government must have been studying it for many years. That does not mean that MJ-12 is real. There is a hall of mirrors one enters as soon as the intelligence community is involved, and we're right in the middle of it. Then I talked to Linda Howe and Fred Beckman, both of whom recommended that I listen to John Lear, who is an impressive fellow, and he said I should talk to you, and here I am, unquote. The waitress brought our drinks. Cooper and his companion lit up their cigarettes, and he began telling me his story. Quote, I became involved in the UFO question as a naval intelligence man, unquote, he said in a matter-of-fact way that I found frank and convincing. Note again his intelligence background, just as Lear apparently has a background in CIA. Continuing. In the period of 1971 and 2, I was ordered to brief several high-level officers about the contents of certain documents that were given to me. Those briefings had to do with the fact that a number of UFOs had been captured by the military and that their occupants have been working along with our scientists. We have entered into a treaty with them. I broke into his statement to make sure I got the essential facts. You're going a little too fast for me, I said. First of all, what was your position in the Navy? Unquote. I was under Admiral Clary as a member of the intelligence briefing team. Unquote. Clary, by the way, capital C-L-A-R-E-Y. Were the documents classified, and at what level? They were classified top secret, S-I. Was there a code word attached to them? Magic with a J was the code word. I'm sure they've changed it now. That's spelled M-A-J-I-C. How long was the briefing and where was it given? There were several briefings, all of which took place at the headquarters for Pacific Operations on the island of Hawaii. The building overlooks Pearl Harbor. The first briefing was a 2.5-hour general overview. Then there were periodic updates as new information came to light. Unquote. He mentioned Admiral Clary, Admiral Wisner, W-E-I-S-N-E-R, and Admiral John McCain as three of the men to whom he had given a full oral report. Why were these officers being briefed, unquote? Because in their operational capacity, they had an immediate need to know. One, they might be required to recover some crashed disks in the future. By the way, that's important. Again, bear in mind, this might be a cover for real things going on, the ETs being the okey-doke. Continuing. One, they might be required to recover some crashed disks in the future. Two, the UFOs might be misconstrued as Soviet offensive devices and fired upon, so they had to be aware of their existence, unquote. Were there instances when the UFOs posed a real threat, I asked? During the Vietnam War, a UFO shot down a B-52. There were also cases when our troops were attacked by things they first thought were helicopters. There was some speculation at the time that the Russians must have entered the war on the North Vietnamese side, so it became a pretty serious matter. Did the Navy ever pick up a disc after that? There was an incident in which I was an actual witness involving the recovery of a craft that was later listed as a Soviet sub. I was in the command center when it happened, and I can assure you it was real, unquote. Bear in mind my earlier caveat that the ETs are an okey-doke. The rest of this might actually, that might be a cover for real activities vis-a-vis circular flying machines developed on Earth by people. Continuing. Have you yourself ever seen an alien? That is the question I have learned to ask of everyone I meet in such circles. No, said Cooper frankly. Have you ever seen part of a crashed disk? No, but I know two different men who were assigned to guard crashed disks and who have spoken to me. Have you ever seen UFOs yourself? Once, in the late summer of 1966, I was on watch aboard a submarine, the USS Tiru, T-I-R-U, SS-416, on the way to Seattle, and three of us saw a disc as large as an aircraft carrier rising out of the sea 2.5 miles away on the port side. It rose and was lost in the clouds, then it came back down again. Did it disturb the ocean? Not really. The water would glide around it as if it was drawn by a force field, unquote. Were there briefings given to high echelon officers before 1971? There must have been, given the information and the documents. The texts stated that the first secret project was established at Eisenhower's orders in 1953. Ike asked Rockefeller to help him in setting up an organization that could conduct a study without government agencies or Congress being aware of the situation. Rockefeller established it under the Jasons, an elite intellectual group. The task force was composed of 12 men, including Kissinger, Dulles, Brzezinski, George Bush, and eight others who became known as the MJ-12 under Operation Majority. Where did they meet? At a place they called the Country Club. This way, they could mention it openly without anyone knowing what they were talking about. It was a piece of land in Maryland which Nelson Rockefeller had set aside for the Jasons. It was only accessible through the air, unquote. And the information that was kept secret had to do with UFOs specifically? With UFOs and with the aliens. There are four types of aliens, unquote. The conversation stopped when the waitress came to take our order. I was not very hungry, and I wanted to make sure I did not lose any detail of Bill's statement, even though most of the things he had said were very questionable. There are four types of aliens, resumed Bill Cooper after the waitress had brought him a second chibis. Quote, there are two kinds of grays, including one race not commonly seen that has a large nose. Then, there are the Nordic types, tall, blonde Aryans, and finally, the orange ones. Note here this description of the, quote, aliens, unquote. Quote, there are two kinds of grays, including one race not commonly seen that has a large nose. Then there are the Nordic types, tall, blonde Aryans, and finally the orange ones. Where do they come from? I remember seeing several points of origin mentioned. Orion, the Pleiades, Betelgeuse, Barnard Star, and Zeta Reticuli. They failed to mention Uranus. Continuing, you mentioned we had a treaty with them since 1964. Why should they go to the trouble of entering into a treaty with us since their technology is far ahead of ours? John Lear mentioned a billion years. Quote, they needed the government to keep their presence secret. Remember, we had one of the aliens in our custody. Our radar affected their navigation system and threw their craft off balance. Unquote. I didn't tell Bill that I had spent the whole afternoon being briefed on advanced microwave devices by an electronic warfare company. That company, based in Orange County, made a radar simulator among its other military products. The idea that our primitive radars of 1949 would have repeatedly knocked alien spacecraft out of the sky was utterly ludicrous. Our own aircraft carry a device lovingly known in the electronic warfare trade as a DERFUM, D-E-R-F-U-M, all in capitals, for, quote, digital radio frequency modulator, unquote, which is a little bigger than a shoebox and has the capability to learn instantly all the characteristics of the electromagnetic sources that are operating in its vicinity, to respond to them, and even to provide false information if necessary in a matter of seconds. It is hard to believe that visiting spacecraft a billion years ahead of us would not have similar or superior capabilities. How are their ships powered, I asked. With a small nuclear reactor the size of a football. They use a space-time fold. I'm not a physicist, so I don't understand that. Apparently, they have the ability to cloak themselves to go invisible. What kind of metal do they use? In the early days, it was pure magnesium. We couldn't duplicate it at the time, but now we could duplicate it in space. That's why there is so much interest in growing crystals in orbit. They use alloys that we can create on Earth, but not with the same pliable structure, unquote. He abruptly changed the subject. Do you know any of the astronauts? I gave him the names of several astronauts I have met. Quote, ask any of the Apollo astronauts about the moon, what they saw there. There's an alien base on the dark side of the moon, unquote. I didn't want to sidetrack our conversation any further, so I didn't tell him that the far side of the moon wasn't dark. What happened to the alien that was captured, I asked. He died in 1952 after being ill for 1 year. The government tried to save him. They broadcast messages into space asking that his people come and help. The result of that was the Holloman landing on April 25, 1964, when another alien came to work with our scientists. He gave us lots and lots of information. The aliens were desperate to have their presence on Earth kept secret. We agreed to that in exchange for their technology. The aliens were given permission to conduct abductions. They said they needed to do them on medical grounds, They were supposed to give MJ-12 the list of humans they abducted. Then we began to realize they lied to us, unquote. Where are the aliens now? At Area 51, everybody thinks it's under the control of the Air Force because it's Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada, but in reality, Area 51 is under the Navy. The Navy has operational control of field activities on this project. That also includes Area 2, which was originally built as an underground storage area for the Atomic Energy Commission. What about Groom Lake? Groom Lake is at Nellis, same thing. There is an alien technical group at Nellis, and there is another one near Dulce, New Mexico, on an Indian reservation. And the discussion goes on from there. Again, Valet, rather subtly, and Valet has noted with his tongue in his cheek some of the obvious and profound contradictions in this account. However, I think, again, people need to very seriously consider the possibility that although the ETs is an okey-doke, that in fact this may be a cover for a variety of other activities. And in particular, I want to note a proto-fascistic, quasi-Nazi, areosophist and racist concept that would appear to be present in this concept that, one of the types of aliens are the Nordic types, tall, blonde Aryans. In his book, The Messengers of Deception, Jacques Vallée points out that the various UFO cults, or many of them anyway, maintain that the aliens, our brothers from space, came down to Earth a long time ago and knew the daughters of man and found them fair, so to speak, and that some of us are descended from aliens and therefore genetically superior to others, and that others are of lowly Earth origins. And note again the blonde Nordic types, and attributing that to space aliens could very easily be used, could be fused, I should say, with a Nazi-type ideology and with the persuasive power of some technologies that have been developed right here on Earth by people, but that are being attributed to aliens. This could be used to impose a rigorous and disastrous system of totalitarian control on people of Earth. And I think we need to be very, very careful of this. I've alluded to the lecture, The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the E.T. Myth. That and a variety of half-hour segments dealing with the E.T. myth and the reality of flying saucers. Again, circular and other unconventionally shaped flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere developed by humans right here on Earth with no help from, quote, E.T.s, unquote. Those various tapes are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, Spitfire. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's also a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. I have an email address at KFJCFM, my home base station. That email address is demory@kfjc.org. That's demory@kfjc.org. Please note that I do not have time to answer correspondence, so don't be offended if you don't get an answer to an email or regular mail. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.